My perspective is it's 100% profitability. If your business isn't profitable, your valuation is trash.
In Stalls, if you go to Stalls' website, you will see that they've got the equipment, they've got transfers, and they've got support. They're putting on so many different in-person events this year. It's been pretty crazy to see. So visit stalls.com, check all that stuff out. They're really trying to help the industry improve. They're a leader in heat printing solutions, and they make the hustle easier. Save 20% off your DTF transfer order. Use that code Hustler20 on your next order. That's Hustler20. Multicraft underscore daddy. Dave at Multicraft has been working with shops for a long time. Multicraft themselves have been around for 50 plus years, providing the industry with top brands at competitive pricing. And Dave's been an incredible partner with so many shops, able to help them too. If you go to Multicraft underscore daddy on your Instagram account, send him a DM with your email address. He's always sending gifts every single week. And a lot of those gifts are PMI tape. We're friends over at PMI tape. And Multicraft worked together to be able to do that. And that is super, super cool. It's just some really great partners that are a good partner in your business. You know, you always need that, especially when shit hits the fan. Next up, GraphX Source. GraphX Source offers industry-leading outsourcing options for your shop by truly becoming a part of your team. Gosh, so many shops are on GraphX Source. They plug and play with Printavo and a bunch of other shop management solutions and handling things like SEPs and mockups, creative art, order management, digitizing some back office admin and customer service. They've been around too, over 40 years in this game. Hit them up, graphxsource.com. Try out their service too. Use the code PrintavoPod24. That gets you 50% off your first order. Last but not least, Easy Way. Every single month, they're giving out $250. This is really great. Every single month, easyway.com/giveaway. It's part of their monthly giveaway program to give back to their amazing customers. Also, easyway.com has a ton of incredible resources too. So that's really incredible. They make reclaiming screens a whole lot easier with their systems, chemicals, and equipment. Head to easyway.com/giveaway and you can claim that product credit or into that giveaway. All right, let's jump on in. Let's go.
It's been so long.
It has been a little while. Steven is MIA today. He's got all these teams in the Final Four March Madness. So he's just like, he texted me. He said, I've never printed and sold so many t-shirts.
That's amazing though.
Yeah, he says thousands of real, I mean, it's just, yeah, there's some crazy numbers here.
What would he have done if the teams that, like, I guess he just pivots to whatever team wins, yeah?
I believe he has the majority or almost all of the teams anyway, like some of the best teams. So regardless, he's kind of winning on either side. But obviously, University of Illinois, that's where they're based out of. That's, you know, where they started, and they're in the Final Four. So that's a big deal.
Gosh, that's a crazy model, dude. What a risk.
Yeah, well, that, and it's like when we had Justin Lawrence at Oklahoma Shirt Company, you know, big Oklahoma Thunder fan and also prints for them. And then it's like, you know, they win, they go ahead and print whatever tens of thousands for the next game. And if not, then either they don't or they sell them cheaper.
That whole deal with OKC and Justin is like fracturing our friendship because I'm a diehard Nuggets fan. He's diehard OKC. It's really a problem for us.
How's your week been?
It's been good, dude. Really good. I've been at the Denver location getting that place dialed. I love it, dude. I was so over Denver. I was like so ready to go more like rural. But now that I'm in like the heart, like the lifeblood of the city, it's just such good energy. We're right by Union Station and it's spring here in Denver. People are out in great moods. The weather's nice.
This is a new lease that you signed, like a proper office type.
Yep. Well, HQ and showroom.
Do people go there every day?
We're trying to get people to do it. Like we were all remote. Wasn't even allowed for so many years. And then everybody had to go remote through the move. And now it's like kind of pulling people back into, like, I'm not requiring them, but I think the more people work there, the more they appreciate it and like to be around people. It's not required, but we're slowly getting more people back in office.
You know, we were just talking about the Steven stuff, and it kind of made me think, you know, with him doing the trailer thing and in like kind of basically pivoting the business to NIL from, you know, more of traditional custom screen printing and the athlete and collegiate stuff, you've taken some big risks too. And I mean, obviously the warehouse stuff has been moving the company has been I would consider a huge risk from the outside. Have there been other maybe pivotal moments or big risks that paid off or maybe didn't pay off?
I don't remember if we talked about this last time. I think we did briefly, but I think the big one for us was just investing in equipment and automation at the wrong time. That was a big mistake, I think.
When was it? That's super interesting. When
you know what year it was, bro. That was the year of PPP loans.
Oh, the frenzy.
Yeah, it was like such a good year, you know, like everything was going, business was booming, and it was like, let's double down. And I've talked about this before, so I'll just say it quickly, but we bought that oval and then we didn't have power. Like we there was a calculation error with the electrician. So it's set, like we bought the oval, started making payments on it, and it sat there for an entire year and we weren't able to use it.
Because of?
We had to pull in more electrical from 6th Ave, and then we had to get all the drawings and stuff approved from the city, and it took a year to approve. So it basically sat there operating as like an oval with 7 flashes, but we could only use 1 flash. So we invested the most we've ever invested in equipment, and we're actually less efficient than we were prior to that purchase.
But if you had the electrical ready, would it have been a good purchase or no?
It would have probably, I wouldn't.
Or would you have not have done it still?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I was so hyper focused. I had just got back from Portugal and was like looking at, you know, the hybrid printer. So I was like, oh, we'll just get an oval now. That way, if we want to go hybrid, we'll have the machine to do it. And I don't feel like we've moved that direction or will.
So that one was like, got too excited about it. But you said, were there multiple pieces of automated equipment that?
Well, we got rid of our M&R dryer. It was like the trusty rusty. There was nothing wrong with it. And then we got a Rock Sahara dryer. And so it was like, yeah, it was a bunch of stuff at once, you know, it all kind of came at once. And then we fell flat for, I've talked about it too before, but 22, 23, and even 24, like sales were not great. So it was just kind of the wrong time to invest. And that was all like attributed to part of getting out of Denver too. High over, like cost of goods higher overhead, taxes are higher, more equipment. It just all compounded to where we're like, we need to like make, it was death by 1,000 cuts. We got to make a big pivot, you know? And so that was risky. And then piggybacking on the last podcast we did, you know, the stopping all marketing, like just basically like putting a wrench in the whole machine, the marketing machine, stripping everything back, and then leaning up with executive team to like stop the bloating. And then slowly, like I still have not even pulled the trigger on any marketing budget. Like we're like, let's see how we do just from repeat business. Cause we had a good idea on our customer levels, like how much of our business is repeat versus new acquisition. And it was like 80% existing customer and repeat. So we just basically have been surviving off that for the last 3 months. And now I'll slowly start infusing marketing back, being very, very intentional and probably less emphasis on social for new acquisition. More social media is like social proof kind of, but SEO and AEO and LLM searchability, like I'm taking the stance that I want people to find us. I don't want to pursue them. And it's like, I've talked about Brist before, but they're the opposite. They have 13 sales reps. They don't invest any money into SEO or social. They're actively finding customers, and we're taking the stance of like, let's let customers find us. So two opposite ends of the spectrum.
We're recording this April 2nd. Generally, a slow period, at least based on our data shows, is like as an aggregate, is things are picking up a lot more normal now. Are you seeing that on your end?
Yeah.
Without the marketing spend?
Yeah.
And what kind of marketing spend? Is there a range we're talking that you were generally spending per month?
We're spending like 4% of our gross revenue a year on marketing, putting that back into marketing. So a lot of SEO and content, like not content through social, but just content and copywriting and backlink and traditional. But like, it's so interesting on the SEO side, because I've done individual, like nerdy dude, I've done agency SEO, back to nerdy, like individual. And like, I think I've landed on paying an individual that just really knows. It's such a weird landscape too with LLM and traditional SEO, but like SEO is the foundation and AEO and LLM is like kind of the next thing that people don't really know the answer to yet of how to, you know, it's just such a new space.
Sure. And what Dom is talking about is large language models like, you know, Gemini and ChatGPT and Grok and Anthropic, and like how people are searching for solutions there now to look for results as if they used to do it in Google. And to be honest, in Google, a lot of times in the top of your search results is the answers, like their AI version of a summary. And so you can click off from there, but you want to start showing up in those types of results too. So it's not just the SEO, it's like, how do we get good at optimizing for like the SEO inside these AI results? Which, yeah, you're right. I've heard it is a lot of, you know, well, are you doing the same things that you're going to show up number one in a Google search result to show up in others? But it seems like there is some additional tailoring too.
Yeah, there definitely is. I mean, you got to think of the end user, like who are you, who's the person, what's your niche market, and who's the person in the organization that's looking at it. And I think Gen Z is heavily relying on their relationship with Claude or ChatGPT. So they're tasked from their CEO to do purchasing. And so they're just going to be having those conversations naturally just on their day-to-day workflow. So they're going to be asking like, you know, hey, I was tasked with this. We need to purchase XYZ apparel, or we need to work with a 3PL company to help with logistics. Like they're going to be finding that information through LLMs probably more than Google nowadays. I think that's my perspective anyway. So we're leaning heavily into that. You can't have really good practice on searchability through LLM unless you have a really solid foundation of SEO. Not to go down a rabbit hole, but I've always found like every time we do our reviews with SEO companies, it's so much fluff because a lot of people don't really understand SEO and backlinking and keyword strategy and competitor analysis. Like you're looking at SEMrush and you're looking at GA4 and you're like,
everyone's been spammed by an
bro, so bad. I mean, unless you really know what you're, and I don't know necessarily like getting in the weeds with it, but I just feel like I've been duped so many times. And that's why I finally was like, I'm just going to strip it all back and just see how we do organically without producing content. And then before we start flooding the internet again with content and copy and backlinks and all that, like let's work with somebody individually that really knows this. And the big question is, do you get just a little ripper that's a Gen Z that really knows all this stuff, or do you work with like a legend that's been in the SEO game for 20-30 years, and are they too crusty to like know all the new tricks? You kind of need something in the middle. Boomer that's like, oh, I've been doing fucking SEO since 1990.
You need a little Gen X that has a little crust on them, I guess, huh?
Exactly. Yeah. You got to have like somebody in the middle, but that's hard to find too, you know, like,
but okay. So it's April though. Have you looked at your March sales compared to last March sales? Right. Cause now that you've turned off the, call it 10 to 15K monthly spend, you're seeing sales kick up, but how did they compare to last year?
Well, for March, it's actually pretty even, dude. Like January, February, we lost a couple of big programs. So I think that's what attributed to our lower sales. Not necessarily like, oh, the floodgates are closed for new acquisition. I think it's just a combo of both. And that's what we've talked about a lot, you know, within this industry is like the shops that can crack seasonality, like win the game, you know, but for us, it's really difficult because we don't, like sometimes spring will be our best time. And then some years like spring is just absolutely trash. So that's where we kind of talked about last time is to mitigate that. You got to get people in contracts. Like you got to get these big programs in contracts and sign them up for 16 months, 24 months. So that when purchasing managers or people inevitably move on in the organization, you're not screwed because they go somewhere else. And I think that's been a big strategy for us, is going after the big dogs, locking them in a contract so that we have some security for 12 months.
Smart. And our space seems to be a little bit allergic to something like that. Maybe thinking that, oh, well, you know, we're good, or it's a little bit of a handshake thing, or like we help them out, and so they'll continue to pay it forward. But you're right. Someone moves on, the relationship changes. The new person may bring someone else, or they may restart the search again.
I've always been like a real handshake guy. Like, I've always told clients, like, I don't want to put you in a contract because I know that if we do a great job, there's no reason to leave. But like I said, you may have a really good person with the buyer, like with Printavo, or, you know, your past, like, what is the life cycle? Like, how long is somebody in a position at a company? It's like 2 years, 3 years, and then they turn over to another. I mean, you got to like realize that that's pretty standard. So you may have the best relationship ever with a client, but that person is not always going to be there. And so like, you want to have a contract so that when somebody else comes in and wants to clean house, like they're bound to us, you know?
So what is a minimum turn generally look like? I'm sure it depends on the type of customer, but you mentioned, you know, 18 months. Is that something you try to standardize? And then what types of customers do you try to do the contract with? Is it a certain size?
It's only 3PL customers. Like, if we're going to manage their Shopify and hold their inventory and do their production, like, we want skin in the game. And I don't know why I've always chosen 16 months. It's like a year is too short. By the time you build up the program, like, your contract is up after things are like finally humming. And then a year is kind of daunting for them. They're like, oh, I don't know if I want to do a 2-year commitment. So 16 months has been the sweet spot. And then after a year of working together, things are ripping, and then you just reevaluate the contract. So we don't even do like, we were doing it with our attorneys, and then they'd have to get their attorneys involved. So we've just been doing simple SLAs of like, hey, this is the benefit of working with us. We're going to be your exclusive decorator. We're going to manage your 3PL. You're not beholden to using us for everything, but we get first right, or we basically get the first right at any domestic decoration. And if it's something that we don't do, you can go outside of us. But typically, once you own their inventory, and that's why I'm a huge advocate of 3PL, is, man, it's so hard to leave, you know?
And does an account manager start reaching out before that 16 months is over?
Yeah, like coming up on a year, a little after a year, then you reevaluate the contract and see if there's anything that needs to change, and then hopefully get them to re-sign another 16.
Is there a way to include in that contract something around minimum decoration spend, for example, or minimum pick and pack spend, right? So it's, you know, you're trying to use it to predict revenue a little bit in that agreement. Because you have talked about, right, well, you're not quite sure what someone will do, and you put up all this work up front and so on, and, you know, we need someone to have basically a proven track record. But can you guarantee it a little bit with a minimum spend, or have you tried that?
No, but a lot of the people that your contracts are kind of pointless unless it's something that, like, you know, when it's like, oh man, this is an incredible opportunity. Like, we know either historical data or forecasting of knowing, like, usually it's 30 plus locations, franchise locations with 30 or more stores. So you know, like, what they're spending monthly. And usually those are hard to negotiate because a lot of times they already are in a contract. So you're getting with them ahead of time so that when their current contract expires
with another decorator.
Yeah. Or 3PL company, or like typically like a management company is who people are on, like big restaurant chains. But that's unique to us. You know, a lot of people don't want to deal with 3PL, and I don't blame them. One of the things that's been keeping me up at night and I've been stressing about is like the print on demand world, because traditional inventory hold models don't work for every business. Like, influencers and creators are not going to have the capital to invest in pre-producing a bunch of inventory, forecasting, and like having like investment in inventory, and then branding changes, and now they're sitting on product. Like, there's definitely a lot of complicated things that go into the inventory hold model, and it takes a big budget. And that's why print on demand is like really vital to those creators and influencers, which is really what we're trying to go after too. So I've been stressing like what to do with DTF. And I think a lot of people do. We're the opposite, dude. We do like big, robust stores of programs that already exist. I think there's a lot of people in our industry that do like the Inksoft and the Chipley and like the more campaign stores. Like, let's just get a store up and running and then maybe it'll be successful. But even if it's not, you're still able to like leverage those relationships a little bit. Like, that just has never worked for us.
Have you been able to take those contracts, that contract strategy, to non-3PL customers? Like, you talk about, okay, if someone's not, you know, an influencer, maybe they're not going to stock, or I don't know, even like a construction company, they order regularly for new employees. They're not stocking anything. Does it work there?
Not for us. No, because like, what is the value of them signing a contract? Like, in order for you to get them in a contract and say, hey, you can't use anybody else, you have to offer them something of like tremendous value. And that value usually comes down to cost. So by getting them in a contract, you're like, why would they want to have exclusivity with a decorator when they can so easily pivot? Like, and so in order for us to say, hey, we want exclusivity, they're going to say, well, okay, so why would I do that? And then you're stuck to being like, well, we'll give you the best pricing, and then you start getting yourselves into like a race to the bottom.
Hmm.
You know, so like it hasn't really worked, and we haven't done the contract thing for just standard decoration, like in and out the door printing. It's always like, we want to run your full program, but that's going to take a massive investment. Like the client that we have, it's been an entire year, over a year, to where it's been fruitful. And that's because they're the second biggest land developer in the nation, because they're buying these old like Kohl's and these retail brick and mortar stores and converting them into this pickleball franchise. And they approached us early on, but it was like, they didn't have anything. Like, we had to build the Shopify, build all the assets, the SKUs. Like, it's a lot, you know, it's almost like we're an agency. So if we're going to put our sweat equity in like building out these robust programs, like, we need to ensure that like, we're going to be their partner and grow together. But with just like a dude printing 1,000 shirts every week, like, contract doesn't really make sense on their end.
I remember a few years ago, you were one of the first people that I knew that raised their minimums way past where people thought was the norm. I can't remember exactly where it was. Maybe you could say that again. And then, is it still there? Is it higher?
Yeah, we went from 24 piece minimums to 100 piece minimums, even for single color, because we were saying like, oh, 24 for first color, 12 for each additional color. And it was so hard to explain. I was like, if we get a 12 color job, what's the bare bones? Like, what's the quantity that we need to justify that working? And it was 100. So like, we're just going to do 100 piece minimums. And like, we rode that out for 2 or 3 years. Yeah. Like, things felt, you know, that didn't work for everybody, but like, it made sense. And we've always thought like, anything less than a $2,500 order value isn't worth our time.
Is that still the case?
We've been a little bit more flexible on it, and then working with Supercolor and doing DTF, like, basically anything, we dropped it down to 72 piece minimum. Anything less than 72, then we'll do DTF. Because, dude, we don't run manuals. Like, we don't run manuals, so it doesn't really make sense to do 24 or 48 piece jobs.
So if you're doing the transfers, are you in theory kind of set up to maybe do some of the on-demand stuff, or are those on-demand projects?
Here's the thing, like, and I don't know how I've got the company at this point. I'm not that knowledgeable, to be honest, but
just trying to keep the fish alive.
Bro, I'm just trying to keep my fish from floating. Y'all know that I'm pretty good at analogies, right? I'm like pretty decent at analogies. So the customer is the customer. DTF and like print on demand, you need a menu. Like, the customer needs a menu to read off of so that they can get the proper ingredients for us to cook the meal or print the shirts, right? And so even if we were like super pro at DTF and we invested in DTF, the amount of information, like, if you don't have the tech stack to like really feed that, and that's where like Fulfill Engine and there's like Gelato and a ton of you know, Printify, Printful, those software companies have like built that menu to where the customer can self-serve. And we have not been able to identify or lock into that buttery software that makes it easy. So even if we were pros at DTF, like it there's so much logistics still that goes into the smaller single unit orders that it's
you realize that when you go to someone like were you there at Jed's tour, his shop tour, Steaks Manufacturing in Ohio? Last year at Print Hustlers, somebody asked Steven, hey, tell me what it's like to get a license, you know, for a couple different, a handful of, you know, colleges to be able to print for them. And he reminded me of the same thing, because Steven's like, explain, he literally said step by step how to do it. And afterwards, people are like, oh, never mind, I'm good. Because it was just so intensive, the back and forth to even just be able to print, let alone to then be able to execute on projects with them. And it was the same thing, I think, with Steaks. Now, granted, it's at another scale, and this is like, we're talking a Walmart Center type building that they're doing this at the size, but it's a different business. It's the same as when you talk about with 3PL. I mean, the way he had it set up and all the different types of on-demand printers, it wasn't just transfers. He was doing digital. The equipment layout, the software, like you said, he built, he has custom software that handles it and orders garments on demand. And, you know, the matching, I mean, the shipping department is unbelievable with the cubbies of, okay, this item has three pieces, so it needs to wait for two others, put it in A1. All right, now, so piece two ties to A1. Okay, now we're waiting, you know, and then ship it out and be able to get it out all on time. Unbelievable. Anyway, that reminded me when you said that.
No, for sure, dude. Like, I just talked to this dude, Josh, at Sunfrog. Have you heard of that company?
He posted something on LinkedIn, actually.
Bro, I saw the same thing and I was like, hey, dude, can we have a meeting? And he was super, super nice to like show me his whole tech stack. And it was like unbelievable. But they were web developers. They weren't even in the apparel business. They were web developers. And it's been like a 10-year process of building this tech stack. Like, they did print on demand before. They were the OGs of POD, I said. And he was explaining this to me. And like, I was so excited to talk to him at first. And by the end of it, like, I was so drained and defeated, because I'm like, bro, insane. I was like, I'll just go sell in my boxers on the couch and try to get 500 piece orders like for the rest of my life versus like having to be a software developer, because we're just not built like that.
I'm going to put the link to his video that he shared in the description so people can watch and have a true appreciation for it. Cause this is actually hard to find. Most people don't want to share their facility like this.
Yeah. You know, he was an open book. He's a sweet guy. Like, he's more than happy to I mean, I would too. If I was proud of something like that, I'd be like, hell yeah, I want to show you what's under the hood.
It scares people away, actually. I think it has the adverse effect.
Yeah. I was like, dude, I was so tired like after I watched that, because it's so counterintuitive to like what we've been as a business for so long. And I think a lot of people are like, I'll just die on the hill of screen printing, dude. I don't care. It's the path of least resistance. But then you start realizing print on demand and DTF has taken so much market share. You even see that when you go to ISS last year. It's like you have Fulfill Engine and all these like tech companies and DTF companies are front and center, you know, like. And when we talk about seasonality and whoever can crack the code of that, the influencer and creator market and the DIY, like, that does like transcend seasonality, because you're not like the resort market where, you know, there's only certain hot times for retail.
I know we're going off track a little bit, but how do you, like, just thinking out loud, how do you think about then if you want to invest in print on demand or not? Like, what is the bottleneck? Is it a cost thing, a time bandwidth thing, a equipment thing, a software thing? How do you process it?
Well, for me, I'm trying not to have entrepreneurial ADD where I just go to like the shiny new object, because I think sometimes I've just taken so much risk over the last 2 years that I'm really careful to be like, okay, this is the new thing, I'm going to jump right into this not knowing anything. I don't necessarily think the fear comes from the DTF, like there's a ton of DTF equipment out there, and like we can go get a DTF printer tomorrow, but is that really going to be smart? Like, do we invest in the tech stack first and figure out like the best flow and the best experience for customers to be able to self-serve? Because if we have a $70,000 a year person that's processing orders, I don't care if you get 300 orders a day DTF, like if it's taking so much bandwidth to process that order, it's not worth it unless you have like a fine-tuned system that the customer can self-serve, like the custom ink experience, you know? So for me, I think about it all the time, but like I got to take smart risks, and I don't think it's a good risk for me to be making a huge pivot into that yet, even though it's coming.
Last time you said, after we stopped recording, you said, I have a ton of notes and stuff that we didn't even get to. I've got a bunch of stuff too, but I wanted to see, was there a couple things on there that you had thought about or wanted to riff on?
I kind of wanted to talk about like what Chris has built with his team. Cause remember we were talking about, I'm never there and he's only there 2 days a week. So how the heck does that work? Like, what does the hierarchy look like there? And so he gave me some notes about what we have.
And explain Chris, by the way, if folks can listen to part one.
Chris is our production manager. So he works, he runs all scheduling in Fountain, but he's only in Fountain 2 days a week, which is wild to most people. But he was talking about like how he builds incentives and the hierarchy of the production team to operate when he's not there. And it's pretty interesting, dude. Like the way that Ryan has built out our production tracker and efficiencies, now printers can be paid a lower base, but have actionable items and targets for efficiency. And we've like realized too that when we set these bonus programs, production bonus programs on volume, then quality always slips. So like, how do you build a metric for like low spoilage and also high output? And I think maybe we'll probably like hold on sharing that system until we, you know, maybe shout out, but maybe like the fabric deal, like we kind of look under the engine a little bit, but it's pretty impressive. Like what Chris has been able to build as an educator and working tandem with Ryan, that I would have never, like that goes back to the executive team and screen printing and like feeling like you're overpaying people, but they build out way more robust systems than the owner ever could. Cause my brain just doesn't work like that.
That's incredible.
Just wanted to shout him out to say like, it's pretty sweet to give an incentive system for production. Cause that's really challenging too. Is like, how do you get your numbers high and your spoilage low? There's got to be like a metric for that.
And they're doing a private Fabric webinar. So if you are interested in joining Fabric, there's a zero to 250K revenue group that we just launched, a lower price tiered program that's helpful for there called Launch. And then there's a higher tiered program as well for to be able to listen to speaker series like this. Is there, for everybody here though, is there one thing that you could share from it that that was helpful? Could be either incentive driven or you know, system driven, or that helps Chris with managing the production facility, especially with 2 days there.
Baseline stats, like having a robust tracking system to where he knows what the standard is of number of pieces, number of colors, job count. Like he knows what we are capable of producing down to the minute of each day. And if you have that baseline, then like when you have a junior or a pro or a print lead, like they're all coming in at different positions, like you know the baseline standard of what you should be producing every day and every hour, which helps with scheduling so much. Because when the girls say like, hey, we just sold a 8-color rush job and it's on 500 pieces and our schedule's already full, like he knows. And a lot of that's the power scheduler in Printavo. Like we hated that thing at first, dude. We were like, this thing sucks. And then we like actually like we put some brain power to it and we're like, no, this is really dope. We were just using it wrong and we weren't doing impressions. And like, so the sewing department has its minutes per, you know, per day, and embroidery department has it, screen department has it. Like, they built out, he has like seven really humming departments based on historical data that we know exactly what we're capable of doing. And then that trickles down into each individual person, what they should be capable of too.
That's really cool. And I know, you know, Matt Marcotte helps educate a lot of folks with that. And Ryan Kasperian, on your team, who does consulting, and both of those guys are so sharp.
I never realized how valuable like those metrics were for a shop. Like, you're out there just winging it. You have no idea. It's like, you're just guessing. It was just so much guessing. And then like white knuckle clinching to get things done and then paying overtime.
Man, what I love though, is that you have team members figuring this out. You're not, I mean, I'm sure you're helping, right? And you're putting people and you're moving blocks out of people's way, but you're saying, hey, look, Chris figured this out with Ryan and he's got these systems. And I had to ask him, hey, how does this work? Like, that's unbelievable. I think that's the state that we should all be in, right? Instead, like, we're enabling, we're sharing the struggles that we have and allowing the really talented people to help build.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes you just got to get out of the way. I think that's the like single most important thing to crack success, is knowing what you're good at and what needs to be passed off, and not having an ego, and be willing to be like, okay, this is not how my brain works. I need somebody that like thrives on this.
I've got about 10 questions that I asked the audience. I asked a couple of different fabric members and some folks. I said, okay, hey, I've got the shop on. Didn't say your name, so they wouldn't have bias. And these are different questions that people wanted to answer. So if we could just, you know, do a quick back and forth. First one was under sales. So to get to, you know, roughly 5 million, and you've talked about, I sometimes hate saying top line revenue because you've shared the struggles and like, look, like literally not making money off of this number, but that's the asterisk, but we'll go with that for the rest of the questions. What were the sales channels and or niches to be able to get there?
Well, like I said before, I think that we've taken a very different approach than most people. And a lot of our investment in time has come from social proof and content. Like, SEO and social media are the two verticals that we use to grow to 5 million. Like, hands down, we've never done outbound sales. We've never been good at it. So those of what have worked for us. But then on top of that, just retention. So we don't pay a commission structure to our account managers. We pay a retention bonus. So Superior Inc, top of funnel, Superior Inc on our content and reputation gets new acquisition. And then the account managers are incentivized to retain those relationships. So once we get them through the door, our highest metric for success is to keep them in the door and upsell them. So I'll just say it. We pay a 0.05, which sounds low, but a 0.05% of gross sales per quarter retention bonus to account managers. So they get a 0.5% of all the business that they manage, which is vastly different than like a 3% or a 5% commission, but they're not hunting, they're cooking. So the point is, like, instead of outbound and getting new acquisition, we've built reputation and content.
So you shared a lot of the do's to get there. What are a few don'ts?
Dude, there's a lot of those.
I don't know if you've shared this publicly, by the way, but what pops in my head is a story you told me about the van.
that's a hell of a story. Well, when we were working in Haiti a bunch for Allmade, I just felt like, oh, I got to be this, you know, a steward of people and giving opportunities. So I started creating opportunities back home and hiring like homeless dudes. I found this homeless dude was hanging out and he said he's a superhero because he saves people from freezing in Denver during the winters. And I was like, oh, that's sick. I'm going to Home Depot to get some plywood. You want to come with me? He hopped in the car And then he starts talking about how he was boxing Joe Frazier and like just crazy shit. So I started recording him. I'm like, dude, we're going to do a documentary on this guy for sure. So we go into Home Depot, hop back in the truck, and my Bluetooth was hooked up to my car speaker and it just started auto playing everything that I recorded. And this guy's like already like conspiracy theorist. And he's like, what the hell is going on? And I had to like explain to him that like, oh, I just think you're interesting. We want to do a documentary, whatever. We got past it. I hired him, started paying for him to go to the rec center to clean up. And my employees are like, what are you doing? Because like he would just inadvertently like start screaming in the middle of the production floor and I'd have to go give him a hug and like talk him off a ledge. And so we had a great relationship, but our employees were like, dude, this is insane. I'm like, just give it time. It's going to be a good story, I promise. Well, fast forward 2 months, it starts getting worse and worse. I finally am like, dude, you can't work here anymore. And so it kind of turned bad and he would just show up and I finally had to get the cops involved because he's like just doing crazy shit. So the cops come and arrest him and then release him the next day. And then he went on a vengeance tear and like knocked out every window in the van and tried to pour diesel fuel all over our bay doors and like light the place on fire. But luckily diesel fuel doesn't burn, you know? And so yeah, he tried to burn our building down and he was like trying to go in and fight Gordy. Gordy had to fight him off with 2x4s and we had to get the cops involved. It was a terrible outcome, but for the 2 months, it was a beautiful story. but full circle, like that was a unique individual situation. But like, I will say the things not to do is what I'm in the season of right now is like, I think we, or at least me personally, you start seeing a little bit of success or you have a good month or a good year. And then you're like, dude, we're closing every deal. Start staffing. Like, we need this person. You need growth. And it's like that old school mentality of fire fast, hire slow is so important. Like hiring slow and intentional is the single most important thing you can do because it's easy to get arrogant and cocky and say things are going really well. Let's triple down. And I think that's probably what's gotten us in the most trouble in the past is just like understanding that like good times come and go and you don't always have to hire every position and hire the best people right away because it's really hard to like cut those positions. You're responsible for those people. So like waiting till the absolute last minute to hire for or like seeing it all the way through before you just add people on. Cause once they're on, like, it's hard to get them off and it's not a fun process.
I read this interesting tweet the other day that I think is kind of related and it's talking about backfilling roles. And this guy said, you know, for a time we used to by default just backfill. Like it was like, yep, someone left. Okay. I got to start finding someone new. He said, I've actually changed that approach now. So by default, I don't backfill. He says that helps create more of a builder mindset with the team, with people having to figure out how do we handle this now? How do we deal with this now without this person? And he said, it's worth seeing how the team adapts to the gap in allowing the team to organize and a better team tends to emerge. And he's like, look, I'm not saying never backfill, but what I'm saying is just give it time. There may be a more creative way to move forward. Or a little bit of time can quickly determine that the role is existing and absolutely needed. And I really like that and kind of piggybacks off of what you're saying.
Well, we started having our CFO give these, like instead of doing analysis meetings on our financials to just me and him, we would do it and then he would share it with the whole team. So what would happen is like we'd have account managers that are like, oh, I feel so busy. I'm like spread thin. Can I please, we need to hire somebody else. This is too much workload. And then we just started showing them the financials. So if we hire a person, you know, a $60,000 salary, we have to 3X the revenue to justify that one position.
And that's where people thought twice about even bringing it up.
Yeah. So if we hire a $12 an hour employee, which, well, it's not 1992 anymore, but say a $20 an hour employee is like, we have to justify the revenue increase for that one person.
Yeah. Brett Bowden at Printed Threads talked about this too, where he would share those numbers as well with the team. So they understood hey, I understand you're feeling stretched thin, but here's exactly why we're not. And here's the metrics to hit to be able to bring someone else on, which, like you said, maybe 3x the revenue or whatever it is.
Yeah, I think just think it's really important. Like, unless you're absolutely like murdering and like wildly profitable and just crushing and paying people a tiny amount, like, which I don't think is the case for most people, it's really insightful to let employees in on it. Like, you got to understand the metrics of this business and know, like, even when it feels like we're killing it, we're really not. Because to my point last time, when I asked our CFO, John, I'm like, how do we operate as a cash business? He's like, dude, you need to be profitable for like 7 or 8 months in a row. Like, if you want enough cash to like pay your vendors out without using a credit card. And I don't think employees know that, you know? And so to bring them in, every time we've done that, like even Amanda, she's been with me for 7 years. She's a gym, but she was like, yo, I need help. And then we kind of shared all this stuff. And she's like, oh, after that meeting, like, I think I could take on more. I could be more efficient with time. You know, it's like a reality check, getting people to think like owners more so than employees.
I like it. This section is under production and a couple questions under here. First, how do you handle test print approvals? What does that QC process look like and who is involved before you run full production on a run?
All right, let me read that. I kind of had a feeling some of this was coming and I'm a little bit removed from it, but Chris said, I'm going to just read this to you because this is his process. So test print approvals go from test shirt to lead press op. They measure and check Pantones. Any questions that need to be answered before lead sign off. So then one good medium or large goes to approval to Nate, who's our floor manager there. And if he has any questions, then it goes to the actual production manager for approval. The first printed garment goes to the catcher for comparison during the run. Tester shirt is marked so finishers know what was approved. So it's pretty like a rigorous process to get things approved. We offer a photo approval for $50. So if the customer wants to see a photo approval and like check everything, they have to pay for it. And then we have a system to notify them 30 minutes before the photo approval is coming to help like mitigate any downtime. Cause that's just an absolute killer when we're waiting on press for an hour for an approval.
And there's no manuals, like you said, so it's sitting.
It's holding up production.
The next question, if you run online stores, do you market those to customers? You talked a little bit about, well, we only do really online stores for established customers. Maybe this is further back if you ever did, like you talked about some of the different online store platforms. Did you ever market those solutions to customers or did people bring theirs to you?
Well, it naturally happened. Like even doing the 3PL is like a common value add. It was just like a common issue of customers over and over having to deal with the 3PL and having us ship to a 3PL. I was very intentional about not marketing 3PL and just like bringing it up casually in conversations to customers that I thought it would benefit. And the reason that we didn't go ham on like advertising it is because it was a slow drip and I didn't want to grow it faster than we could. Like logistics and 3PL are, it's really hard. Like it's not slapping ink on a shirt. It's forecasting and Shopify and tech. And so I was really, really slow and intentional about growing that leg of the business and not trying to grow it too fast to get us in trouble. So I guess to answer the question, like, no, it wasn't something that we really marketed. Now that we're good at it, then yes, it's kind of changing our whole strategy from being a like t-shirt printer to a brand built for brands. So I feel like a little bit more confident selling it now that we have proven to ourselves that it works and that we're good at it. But it's taken 3 years to get confident.
I like it. At a $5 million shop, what does the team makeup look like? How many maybe account managers, how many artists, production staff, and so on?
Yeah, so we have three account managers and then one outbound. I know I said we don't do sales. This is the first time that we've started outbound. So one outbound, three account managers, fractional CFO, fractional CTO. We had a CMO all the way up until the end of last year. So that's kind of how the executive team is. And then we have an accountant and a fractional CPA. As far as production goes, we have one floor lead, three press ops, three pullers, one catcher, and three support finishers, and then two people and 3PL. So I don't know what that, I think it's 26 people total.
Yeah. And then art team, did you mention that?
Art, we have two contract illustration artists, and then we had an in-house art director for all SEPs and mocks. We were actually using GraphX now.
Okay. Second to last section. What's your number one stressor in the business today?
Whether or not we should get into print on demand. That's number one. And then just like minimizing volatility and stabilizing profitability. We've had a hard time showing a profit the last couple of years. So that's the stressor, is like, how do you beat seasonality? The answer is to get people in contracts and to be super intentional with marketing our business the right way to like the people that actually add value, because marketing is silly and pointless unless it's attracting the right people.
And last question, you mentioned it last time, but for valuation, you hinted at this a little bit. How do you think about increasing valuation for Superior Inc.? And what are the things that you do to be able to accomplish that?
Well, that's, we're in the season of that right now. It's 100%. My perspective is it's 100% profitability. If your business isn't profitable, your valuation is trash. I've said this before and I'll say it again, but I always thought that the value of your business was the combination of like the assets that you own, profitability, and then systems. Profitability and systems, 100%, equipment and assets, not so much. Because it depreciates and it's just like a car, you know, like those, the equipment is super essential, but it's not essential from the asset perspective. It's essential from like the profitability side. And we all know that like in our business and manufacturing high touch, you know, like an EBITDA, you're lucky to get like a 3 or 4X. So if you're not profitable, these businesses are worthless, really. Like, you know, you have to be able to turn a profit, and that's been tricky for us the last couple of years, but that's where you got to operate super lean and efficient, niche into your customers, and not go where the trends are, just go what works for your business. So I'm like, dude, I'm 15 years in kind of learning that.
I like it. Dominic, thank you for sharing. Part two. Print Hustlers, we appreciate you guys always joining us every single week. This was another special one. We'll see you guys next week. Steven will be back. Well, maybe he'll be back. I guess if his team wins, they keep rolling on. So anyway, hopefully you guys enjoyed this episode. Have a great one.
Bye-bye.
Thanks so much for listening. Hopefully that was informative. Don't forget to subscribe. Don't forget to like. Don't forget to hit the bell for notifications if you enjoyed this video. If you enjoy all the stuff we're putting out, it's really helpful. We love to just be able to see it. That means that we're doing a good job. To subscribe, hit the bell for notifications, and hit the like button. And I'll see you in the next episode. Bye.